If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Before he was an NBA superstar, before the gold medals, the commercials, or the headlines, Chris Paul was just a teenager from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And his biggest fan in the world was his grandfather, Nathaniel Jones. Mr. Jones owned a small service station on the south side of town for nearly 40 years. And every summer, he brought Chris to work with him, teaching him the value of hard work. When basketball season rolled around, Mr. Jones would close up early just to make it to his grandson's games. In November 2002, Mr. Jones attended the ceremony when Chris accepted a full scholarship to play basketball at Wake Forest University. He watched, smiling ear to ear, as Chris signed his letter of intent in front of a packed gym full of family, friends, and classmates, all chanting his nickname, CP3, a nickname Mr. Jones bestowed upon his grandson, and one Chris Paul still goes by to this day. When the signing ended, Mr. Jones walked with Chris outside the gym. There, away from the noise and cameras, he told his grandson he would remember that day for the rest of his life. It was one of the happiest moments Chris Paul and his grandfather had ever known. But that joy wouldn't last. The very next day, November 15th, 2002, 61-year-old Nathaniel Jones was found beaten, bound, and gagged in his own driveway, murdered in the very neighborhood he'd spent his life serving. His family was devastated. Days later, Chris stepped onto the basketball court for his last high school season opener with a heavy heart. He decided to play the game in his grandfather's honor, and that night, he scored 61 points, one for every year of his grandfather's life. As the clock wound down, Chris was just a few points shy of breaking the state record for the most points ever scored in a high school game. But in the final minutes, he did something no one expected. He deliberately missed a free throw and walked off the court, leaving his total points at 61. Chris broke down, collapsing into his father's arms before he even reached the bench. The touching tribute made headlines in the local paper. And in that same paper, there was another headline taking shape. Police had made arrests for the murder of Nathaniel Jones, but it was who police accused that had the community stunned. The crime was brutal, the details unthinkable, and yet the defendants were barely teenagers. They would become known as the Winston-Salem Five. Their confessions to the police would seal their fate, and their confessions about the police would expose a far more complicated truth. For the next two decades, Winston-Salem would wrestle with one impossible question. Were these boys cold-blooded killers or victims of a system desperate to find them guilty? The prosecution says they were looking for an easy target. The defense says they were the targets, but it's the jurors who have the final say. This is 13th Juror Podcast, where we break down real court cases and put you in the juror's seat. Two sides, the same evidence. You decide what to believe. I'm your host, Brandi Churchwell. Today's episode is North Carolina versus the Winston-Salem Five. Part one, the prosecution's case. It was a cool Friday evening on November 15th, 2002. After nearly 40 years of running Jones Service Station on the south side of Winston-Salem, Nathaniel Jones followed the same familiar routine he had for decades. He closed the register, locked the pumps, and gathered his checks and bank deposits before locking the doors around 6 o'clock. His nephew Terry rode along with him, just as he always did. Terry had worked with his uncle for about a year, helping with mechanic work at the shop. Every morning, Mr. Jones picked him up at 6:15 a.m. They had breakfast and lunch at the same little restaurant, then locked up around 6 each evening before Mr. Jones dropped him off at home. It was a long work day, but Terry valued their routine and the time he got to spend with his uncle. Mr. Jones' daughter, Robin, knew that routine by heart, too. Every morning, her father called her at 6. Every evening, he called again when he was leaving the station. That afternoon, on the way home, Mr. Jones stopped at a small neighborhood store. He handed Terry a few dollars to run in and grab a Sprite and a pack of cigarettes, and he chatted with Robin on the phone while he waited in the car. Robin's sister had arranged for a painter from Charlotte to come by that evening to look at their father's house. The plan was simple. Meet the painter that night, sign a contract, and pay him $600 cash, then have the interior of the house painted over the weekend. Robin reminded her dad about the painter coming, but he reassured her he hadn't forgotten. He'd meet him as soon as he got home. Mr. Jones dropped Terry off at his house and told him he'd pick him up in the morning, then drove off toward his home on Moravia Street. It was the last time anyone in his family would hear his voice. The painter was with his wife on his way to the house, but was having trouble finding it, so he called Mr. Jones to double-check that he had the right address. When Mr. Jones didn't answer his phone, he called his daughter, who had initially hired him. When she heard her father wasn't answering, worry set in. She called her sister, and both began trying to reach him. When their calls went unanswered, one of them called her husband and asked him to drive over and check on their dad. Around 7:45 p.m., the painter finally pulled into Mr. Jones' driveway. The porch light was off, but his Lincoln Town Car sat parked under the carport, so the painter assumed he was home. He rang the doorbell and waited, but there was no answer. He walked to the side of the house where the carport door was and knocked again. Still nothing. The carport was narrow, just wide enough for a single car. The space between the wall and the car was barely a few feet. As he stepped down from the stoop, his foot caught on something. Too dark to see, he called to his wife to turn on the headlights. When she did, the beam washed across the driveway, and what it revealed would haunt the painter and Winston-Salem for decades. Nathaniel Jones was lying face down beside his car. His hands were bound behind his back with black tape. More tape was wrapped around his head and neck, covering his mouth like a gag. His shirt was bloodstained, and he wasn't moving. Across the street, the painter spotted two people standing on a front porch. Tarsha Coleman, who lived directly across from Mr. Jones, and her friend, Calvin Scriven, who had just walked over to visit her and had just helped the painter find Mr. Jones' house minutes earlier. When the painter called out for them, Calvin ran over and saw what the painter had seen: Mr. Jones lying motionless on the ground. He knelt down and lifted his head slightly. For a moment, he thought he could hear a faint and fading pulse, but he couldn't be sure. So he shouted back for Tarsha to call 911. Within minutes, police swarmed Moravia Street. Paramedics arrived and moved Mr. Jones out from the cramped carport, but it was too late. He was gone. A small crowd had already gathered behind the yellow tape. Neighbors, concerned onlookers, even a few curious teenagers craning their necks to see what was happening. Detectives started working quickly, trying to piece together Mr. Jones' final hours. They spoke to Terry, who said his uncle had dropped him off sometime before 6:30 that evening. And they spoke to Robin, who confirmed she'd talked to her father on his drive home. Then they canvassed the neighborhood, knocking on doors, asking questions, looking for anything that could explain what had happened. Did he have any enemies? Anyone who would want to hurt him? Neighbors mentioned a string of break-ins nearby, but no one could imagine who would harm Mr. Jones. Investigators tried to retrace his last movements, hoping to find even the smallest clue that could explain who did this and why. Detectives picked up on a few details that seemed out of place. The light bulb in the carport had been unscrewed. There were footprints on the hood of Mr. Jones' Lincoln, and a set of keys still hung in the door, which was slightly open, but nothing inside appeared to be disturbed. Under the car, they found three pieces of mail, a broken storm door handle, and Mr. Jones' shattered watch. In the trunk of his car, detectives also found his briefcase containing nearly $1,500 in cash. And he had another $900 in his pocket. But his wallet was nowhere to be found. As the family and the community grieved, detectives dusted for fingerprints, gathered evidence, and searched for clues. But days passed without any answers. There were a few tips, potential sightings of suspicious activity, but nothing that led investigators anywhere promising. Yet. That all changed with one phone call. A single tip 4 days after the murder that would change the course of the investigation. Within hours, five local boys would be in handcuffs, and Winston-Salem would never see justice the same way again. Based on the testimony and evidence they presented, this is the prosecution's story. In the days before that fateful tip came in, detectives had a murder case on their hands, but no suspects, no witnesses, and no clear motive. While investigators worked through the night collecting evidence, prosecutors would later tell jurors that on the other side of town, another story was already unfolding. It all started hours before Nathaniel Jones ever pulled into his driveway. According to prosecutors, five boys, Rayshawn Banner, Nathaniel Cawthon, Darrell Brayboy, Christopher Bryant, and Jamal Tolliver, weren't thinking about school or basketball that Friday evening. They were talking about money and how to get some fast. There wasn't anything specific they needed. They just wanted what the state called easy money. Money the boys say they could make by jacking somebody up. According to the prosecution, jacking somebody up was their own slang for robbery. And as the sun went down over Winston-Salem, that talk turned into a plan. That Friday night, the five boys rode around Winston-Salem with 16-year-old Jessica Black, stopping at different houses, a park, and a few corner stores like Dollar General and Maxway. From the outside, it looked harmless, just teenagers wasting time on a Friday night. But prosecutors said those stops weren't random, because it was in those aisles that the boys picked up black tape and do-rags, the same tools the state argued that would later be used to cover their heads and bind their victim. They talked about finding someone easy to rob, someone older, someone alone, someone who carried cash. And while Mr. Jones was driving his nephew home and making a couple stops of his own, those five boys were already hunting for a target. They didn't know his name, but soon they would know his address. This is where two lifestyles, one built on routine and hard work, the other on impulse and opportunity, collided on a chilly November night. Those five young men set out that evening with a single purpose, to rob someone. And in the process, they took a man's life. The prosecution's story was built. Now it was time to tell it. Rayshawn Banner and his brother Nathaniel Cawthon were the first to go to trial in August of 2004. They were charged with first-degree murder and robbery with a dangerous weapon. Despite being only 14 and 15 at the time, they were tried as adults. The second trial for Darrell Brayboy, Jamal Tolliver, and Christopher Bryant followed in May of 2005. They were each charged with second-degree murder and common-law robbery. And, just like Banner and Cawthon, they were also tried as adults, despite each boy barely being 15 years old. In opening statements for both trials, prosecutors painted a story of contrasts. On one side was Nathaniel Jones, a hardworking family man, a fixture in his neighborhood, someone who spent decades serving his community, closing his gas station each night with the same quiet routine. And on the other were five teenage boys uninterested in hard work or earning money the honest way. They were bored, broke, and out looking for trouble. That night, their version of fun would end in tragedy. They said this case wasn't about mystery. It was about accountability. And the confessions, witness testimony, and physical proof would show exactly how a hardworking man's life intersected with five boys' bad intentions on one November night in Winston-Salem. And it would all center around the testimony of the state's star witness, Jessica Black. At 16, Jessica had lived what most would call a sheltered life. Her free-spirited personality often clashed with her mother's strict rules, so she eventually moved in with her grandmother and started attending North Davidson High School. But Jessica had grown up on the south side of Winston-Salem, and that's where her friends were. So every afternoon after school, she'd climb into her black 1986 Mercury Cougar and drive back across town to hang out until it was time to head home. Most nights, it was harmless fun. Cruising around, stopping by friends' houses, hanging out at the mall or creekside bowling lanes, and often spending time at Bellevue Park. On Friday, November 15th, 2002, Jessica followed the same routine. She'd recently been seeing a guy for a few weeks. Nothing serious, but through him, she'd met a new circle of friends. And she'd been spending more and more time with them over the past month. One of these new friends, the one she grew closest to, was 15-year-old Nathaniel Cawthon. Jessica testified that on the afternoon of November 15th, Nathaniel Cawthon and his younger brother, Rayshawn, were hanging out at Chris Bryant's house on the south side, a regular gathering spot for the group. Chris lived right across the street from the guy Jessica had been seeing, which is how she'd met them all in the first place. When she pulled up, she saw Chris, Nathaniel, and Rayshawn sitting on the porch talking. Before long, another friend, Darrell Brayboy, joined them. They decided to pile into Jessica's car and ride around. As they cruised through town, they ran into another local boy named Jed, who lived on Moravia Street, near Bellevue Park. Jessica agreed to give him a ride home, so he climbed into the car with the others, and together, they headed toward Moravia Street, unaware that what was about to happen next would change all of their lives forever. Jessica said the conversations in the car that day had turned toward the talk of money, and how none of them had any. The boys started saying they wanted to make some the easy way, without having to work for it. They didn't talk about robbing someone. What they said was that they wanted to jack somebody up. At first, Jessica said she didn't take it seriously. She'd heard that kind of talk before. It was typical teenage boy bravado, not an actual plan. But then, she said, the conversation changed. They started talking about specifics. Jed told the boys about a house a couple blocks up from his, where there's an old man who might make the perfect target. He didn't give a name or description, but said the man got home around the same time every night and usually carried cash or credit cards. By the time they dropped Jed off at his house on Moravia Street, the plan seemed to have been set in motion. It was around dusk when the boys said they wanted to go to Dollar General. When they pulled up, the brothers, Rayshawn and Nathaniel, stayed in the car with Jessica. Darrell and Chris went inside, and about 5 to 10 minutes later, came back out with some do-rags. Next, they headed back toward Chris's house to pick up their friend Jermall Tolliver, who lived right across the street. Then they went to a discount store called Maxway, a kind of small-town Big Lots. Jessica and Rayshawn stayed in the car again while the others went inside. A few minutes later, they returned. This time, they had a roll of dark-colored tape. Prosecutors told the jury these two stops were no coincidence. They were preparation. The boys were gathering supplies, makeshift tools for a robbery. After that, Jessica and the five boys, Nathaniel and his brother Rayshawn, Chris, Jermall, and Darrell, drove to Bellevue Park on Moravia Street. By the time they reached Bellevue Park, daylight was fading, and the streetlights had just started to flicker on. Jessica pulled her car into a parking spot near the picnic area. The air was cool and the park was quiet. From the park bench, she could see the glow of porch lights lining Moravia Street just beyond the trees. The group climbed out of the car and walked toward the picnic tables. Jessica sat down on one of them while the boys stood nearby, talking amongst themselves and looking down the road toward the houses. Suddenly, Nathaniel Cawthon said, "There's the car. Come on." Jessica testified that Nathaniel and Chris Bryant grabbed sticks and headed down the road. Rayshawn and Darrell followed suit. Jermall, the last to join the group that day, was the last to join the boys down the road, too. He waited a few minutes, but then he followed as well. A few minutes passed, then Jessica heard voices. She recognized Chris's voice and heard the brothers, Nathaniel and Rayshawn, yelling, "Get the fuck down! Give us that shit!" Then she heard a voice she didn't recognize pleading, saying, "Stop! Leave me alone!" She heard what sounded like hitting, dull, heavy, and rhythmic, but she couldn't see what was happening. 5 or 10 minutes passed until she saw the boys running back toward her through the darkness. They were laughing, yelling, and saying things like, "Yeah, we got that shit, and we fucked him up." When the boys reached Jessica, they told her it was time to go. The group ran to the car. Jessica opened the door and lifted the front seat forward so they could climb in the back. As she did, she noticed something in Nathaniel's back pocket. Something square, shaped like the imprint of a wallet. But she never knew him to carry a wallet. Jessica got behind the wheel and asked the boys where they wanted to go. They told her they needed to change clothes, so she headed toward Darrell's house first. On the drive, the conversation turned to money again. Only this time, not about how they didn't have any, but about how they should split it up. Prosecutors told jurors the money they were talking about came from the man they had just jacked up, Mr. Nathaniel Jones. In court, the state painted a vivid picture for the jury, weaving Jessica's testimony together with the evidence collected at the scene. They said the group saw Mr. Jones pull into his driveway from the park, and they quietly made their way toward his house. They showed jurors photos of a grocery bag sitting on the table just inside Mr. Jones' side door, the Sprite he'd bought earlier still inside of it. They claimed that the boys watched as he carried it in and set it down. Photos of the 3 pieces of mail found beneath Mr. Jones' car revealed that he'd stopped to check his mailbox before heading back toward the carport. And that's when the boys made their move. They knocked him to the ground and used the black tape Jessica had described to bind his hands and cover his mouth, silencing his cries for help. Mr. Jones fought back, struggling to free himself. The carport light, set to a motion sensor, flickered on, so one of the boys climbed onto the hood of the Lincoln and unscrewed the bulb, leaving behind a distinctive circular shoe print jurors saw in crime scene photos. These 5 boys set out to rob an old man, and when he fought back, they made sure he couldn't fight anymore. They beat him, they bound him, they stole his wallet, and they left him there, bloody, alone, and gasping for breath on the cold concrete floor of his carport. As the boys fled and discussed how to split the money, the robbery turned deadly. The tape over Mr. Jones' mouth made it difficult for him to breathe. A medical examiner testified for the prosecution that he suffered blunt force injuries to his head and that his already weak heart couldn't withstand the stress of restraint and fear. His cause of death? Cardiac arrhythmia due to multiple blunt force head injuries. To the state, it was simple. This was a robbery that became a murder, and 5 young men chose to take money they hadn't earned at the cost of an innocent man's life. When the violence ended, the night kept moving. And while Mr. Jones lay dying in his driveway, his attackers were already making their way home. They were changing clothes so they could go out and spend the money they had just stolen from their victim. Jessica drove first toward Darrell's house, since he lived further east than the rest of the group. Then she dropped off Chris and Jamal before taking Nathaniel and Rayshawn home to change. A short while later, they all regrouped at Chris's. They piled back into Jessica's black Mercury Cougar, this time heading toward the mall. When they arrived, the boys went one way and Jessica went another. They agreed to meet back in about 30 to 45 minutes. When she made her way back, she spotted the boys upstairs near a jewelry store, laughing, joking, acting normal. Not long after they left the mall, they made their next stop, Creekside Bowling Lanes. Creekside was a familiar hangout for kids in Winston-Salem. It had bowling lanes, pool tables, and an arcade, and Jessica had personal ties to that spot. Her grandmother was a regular there, and the employees, even the off-duty officers who worked security, knew her by name. They hadn't been there long, maybe 40 minutes, when one of those officers approached. He told Jessica she needed to take her friends and leave. The officer later testified that he'd seen a group of teens loitering in the lobby, an area he tried to keep clear unless someone was waiting for a ride. When he told them to move along, 2 of them, later identified as Nathaniel and Rayshawn, mouthed off. Nathaniel turned to his brother and said, "Why is he fucking with us?" That was enough for the officer. He walked the boys outside to Jessica's car, where Jamal and Darrell were already waiting, and told Jessica to get them out of there. They weren't allowed back. They left the bowling alley, made a couple of short stops, then headed back toward Bellevue Park because the boys were curious to see if anyone had reported their robbery. But as they turned the corner toward the park, they were met with a wall of flashing lights. Police cars were everywhere. Roads were blocked off, and blue and red lights bounced off houses and trees. Jessica couldn't even make it to the park from that direction. She had to loop around the block because the entire area had been shut down. When she finally parked nearby, the boys jumped out and started walking toward the commotion. Jessica hesitated. Unsure what to do, she sat in her car for a few minutes, then stepped out and walked toward the fence by Mr. Jones' house. Neighbors gathered behind the crime scene tape, whispering and watching. Jessica walked up to a woman and asked what had happened. The woman told her that someone had attacked Mr. Jones. Jessica looked past the crowd, and that's when she saw it. Mr. Jones' body, lying on the driveway between a van and the carport, covered by a blanket. Her stomach dropped. She turned back toward the boys and urged them to leave. They got back into the car and drove off. According to Jessica, on their drive away from the crime scene, Nathaniel Cawthon told everyone to stick to one story. Say they went to the mall, the bowling alley, rode around, and that was it. Rayshawn backed him up, reminding everyone that their story had to stay the same. She dropped Jamal, Darrell, and Chris at Chris's house, then drove the brothers home before heading back herself. She saw them again briefly the next day, and after that, she didn't see them for the rest of the weekend. On the afternoon of Tuesday, November 19th, 4 days after the murder of Nathaniel Jones, detectives with the Winston-Salem Police Department got their first real break. The call came from Arlene Tolliver, the mother of 15-year-old Jamal. She told detectives that her son had not been the same since the homicide on Moravia Street. He'd been quiet, staying inside, avoiding his friends, especially Nathaniel and Rayshawn, the boys she said he was usually inseparable from. She thought, maybe he knows something. Maybe he even knows who was responsible. When detectives arrived at the Tolliver home, they found Jamal sitting on the front porch. They told him his name had come up in a current investigation and asked if he'd come down to the station and talk. Jamal did try to run. He didn't argue. In fact, he agreed to their proposal. At first, Jamal denied everything, said he didn't know anything about a murder. But as the hours passed, the questions got harder. He was told this was serious, that he needed to tell the truth. And then they told him his own mother believed he knew something. And that's when he broke. He admitted there'd been a plan to rob somebody, but he never meant for anyone to get hurt. It was all Nathaniel and Rayshawn's idea. And Jessica was the getaway driver. He was just the lookout. And that's where the confessions began. In a matter of hours, police were able to round up the other five teens. First, they found Darrell, then Nathaniel, followed by Chris and Jessica. Although Rayshawn was with Nathaniel when the two were first approached by law enforcement, he had refused to join his brother at the police station at that time. Despite his refusal, he eventually ended up there later that night. Prosecutors tell the jury that none of them admitted to anything, at least not at first. And that's not unusual, they said. That's what criminals do. They deny. It was only when each of the five teenagers sat alone in separate interview rooms and the detectives began moving from room to room that the picture came together. Each of them realized they were caught and decided to confess. Some of their details varied, which detectives said wasn't surprising. Everyone wants to minimize their own role. But overall, the story lined up. And it was dark. Earlier that night, they had talked about jacking somebody up and about making money the easy way. So when Jessica drove them to Bellevue Park that night and they saw Mr. Jones Lincoln turning down the street, they made their move. They approached his house as he carried a grocery bag inside. One boy acted as a lookout. One took the first swing, and the others piled on, beating him with their hands, maybe with sticks, maybe even with a bat. They used the black tape from Maxway to bind him, and when Mr. Jones cried out for help, they used the tape to silence him. One boy stood on the hood of the car to unscrew the light bulb in the carport, leaving behind a distinctive footprint. When the struggle ended, one of them grabbed Mr. Jones' wallet and tucked it away. Jamal told detectives they tried to use the cards at the mall the next day, and when the cards didn't work, they tossed the wallet out of a bus window, never to be found again. The state said the confessions shifted the entire investigation. Police searched each suspect's home, collected clothing, shoes, even a baseball bat. Most of it was eliminated, but one piece of evidence tied everything together for the prosecution: the shoe print. The bottom of a Nike Air Force One has one of the most distinctive treads in sneaker design. Even if you're not a sneakerhead, you've probably seen the iconic circular bullseyes, one under the toe and one under the heel. When the investigators saw that same ring pattern impression on the hood of Mr. Jones' car, they recognized it immediately. In total, police collected 8 pairs of Air Force Ones from the defendant's homes. A footwear impression analyst enlarged photos of the print lifted from the Lincoln's hood and concluded it was consistent in size, pattern, and wear with a pair belonging to Rayshon Banner. This was all the physical evidence the prosecution needed, along with the confessions and testimony of Jessica Black, and that single shoe print. They believed they had proved exactly what happened in Mr. Jones' driveway. By the time the state rested its case, the courtroom had heard it all. 5 confessions, 1 eyewitness, and a single footprint that tied everything together. Now it was time for the lawyers to make their final appeal. One last chance to shape how the jurors would see everything they'd heard. The air in the courtroom felt heavy, the weight of 10 days of testimony pressing on everyone inside. This was the moment that would decide it all. In closing arguments, prosecutors stood before the jury and painted 2 pictures. The first of Nathaniel Jones, a man who'd spent 40 years serving his community. The man who fixed tires on credit, who closed his shop early to watch his grandson play basketball, who'd done everything right, only to be ambushed in his own driveway. The second picture was of 5 teenagers out looking for somebody to jack up. There was nothing mysterious or coincidental about this case. It came down to choices: the decision to plan a robbery, to follow through on it, and to ensure the victim could never identify his attackers. Jurors were reminded of the evidence: the tape, the missing wallet, the confessions, and the footprint on the hood of the Lincoln. Every detail matched. Even if each boy tried to soften his own role, their stories fit together like pieces of the same puzzle. Then a photo of the car, with a faint outline of a shoe print across the dusty hood, was held up for all to see. The prosecution claimed, "That's the mark of the man who tried to silence Nathaniel Jones." Mr. Jones didn't die quietly. He fought. And the marks on his car, the blood on his clothes, and the bruises on his body proved it. Prosecutors painted a vivid picture of a robbery that turned into murder. This was not a tragic accident, but a deliberate act of violence by 5 young men who thought they could take what they wanted and walk away. And when the state finished their arguments, their message was clear. Nathaniel Jones fought for his life, and now they were fighting for justice. With 5 confessions on record and Jessica Black's testimony tying every thread together, it seemed like an open and shut case. Prosecutors were confident the jury would see it that same way. But there's a reason this case is still being talked about more than 20 years later. And in the next episode, you'll find out why. From confessions that were later recanted to interrogation techniques that the defense says led to false admissions, and bombshell revelations that drew in the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission, plus the shocking truth about where they are now: 2 men free, 2 still behind bars, and 1 the victim of a violent murder himself. Because in Winston-Salem, the story of Nathaniel Jones' murder didn't end with the verdict. That was only the beginning. We'll be right back.
Good news! Goodwill Columbus has opened a new store in Westerville. And with a new donation center, it's easier than ever to make a difference in your community. Bring your gently used clothing, furniture, electronics, and more to our donation drop-off. Each donation and purchase supports our mission to provide jobs, free job training, essential services, and more right here in Westerville. Drop your donations off at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons, from tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond. Every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.